That it was. And funny, too. Or tragic, I'm not really sure. Since I started this journal, I guess I've lowered my sights, in fact. My original idea was to discover the harmony in the movement of the world, and here I am about to describe well-bred ladies squabbling over a pair of lace panties. But anyway, I think that in any event, I didn't fully believe in it. So while I'm at it, I may as well just have some fun. Here's what happened. With Maman, we went into a boutique of fine lingerie. Fine lingerie is already an interesting name. What else would it be? Chorus lingerie? Anyway, what it means, in fact, is sexy lingerie. You won't find your grandmother's sturdy old cotton drawers in a place like this. But since it's the Rue Saint-Honoré, obviously it's sexy chic, with hand-stitched lace bottoms, silk thongs, and cashmere nightgowns. We didn't have to stand in line to get in, but it would have been better if we had, because inside the boutique, we were crammed shoulder to shoulder. It was like being inside a ringer. Cherry on top, Maman immediately went into ecstasies when she started digging through a pile of underwear in really dicey colors. Red and black, or petrol blue. I wondered where I could hide and find shelter while she looked for, faint hope, some flannelette pajamas, and I threaded my way toward the back of the fitting rooms. I wasn't alone. There was a man, the only man, and he looked as dejected as Neptune when he's missed a shot at Athena's hindquarters. That's the downside of I love you, dear. The poor guy gets dragged off to a steamy session of trying on chic underwear and finds himself in enemy territory, with 30 females in a trance who step on his feet and look daggers at him whenever he tries to park his cumbersome male carcass somewhere. As for his lovely lady friend, she has been metamorphosed into a vengeful fury, ready to kill for a fuchsia tanga. I shot him a glance full of sympathy, to which he responded with the expression of a hunted beast. From where I stood, I had an unrestricted view of the entire shop, and of Maman, who was drooling over some sort of teeny-tiny bra made of white lace, at least there was some lace, and huge purple flowers. My mother is 45, a few pounds overweight, but the big purple flower doesn't frighten her off. The sobriety and chic of a uniform beige, on the other hand, would leave her paralyzed with terror. Anyway, there's Maman painstakingly extirpating this mini floral bra from the rack, and she thinks it's her size, and she reaches for the matching panties 3 racks lower down. She's tugging on them with determination, but suddenly she frowns. At the other end of the panties, there is another lady, who is also tugging on the panties and frowning. They look at each other, look at the rack, and realize that these panties are the last survivors of a long morning of sales. They prepare to do battle, each armed with her most ingratiating smile. And now the stage is set for an interesting movement. A pair of panties at 130 euros does not amount to much more than a few centimeters of ultra-fine lace. So you have to smile at the other woman, hold firm to the panties, and pull them towards you, but without tearing them. I'll tell you straight out, if in our world the laws of physics are constant, this will not be possible. After a few seconds of unsuccessful endeavor, the two ladies say amen to Newton, but don't give up. The war will have to be fought using other means, diplomacy, one of Papa's favorite words. And this results in the following interesting movement. Pretend to be unaware of pulling firmly on the panties while asking for them with faux courtesy. So here are Maman and the other lady, and all of a sudden, it's as though they have each lost their right hand, which is in fact clinging to the panties. It's as if the panties did not exist. As if Maman and the lady were chatting quite calmly about a pair of panties that were still on the rack, that neither one would ever dream of trying to expropriate by force. Where has my right hand gone? Poof! Vanished! Disappeared! Time for diplomacy! As everybody knows, diplomacy always fails when there is an imbalance of power. No one's ever seen the stronger party except the other party's diplomatic proposals. As a result, the negotiations, which began in unanimity with, Oh, I think I was quicker than you, chère madame. Don't get you very far. When I went up to maman, they had reached the point of, I won't let go of them. And it's easy enough to believe both warring factions. And of course, maman lost. When I came up next to her, she remembered that she is a respectable mother, and that it would not be possible for her, unless she wanted to sacrifice all dignity before my eyes, to send her left fist smack into the other woman's face. So she regained the use of her right hand and let go of the panties. End result? One left with the panties, the other with the bra. Maman was in a foul mood all through dinner. When Papa asked what was going on, she replied, You're a member of Parliament. You should pay more attention to the degradation of people's attitudes and civil behavior. But let's get back to the interesting movement. Two women, in full possession of their mental capacities, who suddenly become totally unfamiliar with a part of their body. It results in a very odd spectacle, as if there were a break in reality, a black hole opening up in space-time, like in a real sci-fi novel. A negative movement, a sort of hollow gesture in a way. So I said to myself, If you can pretend to ignore the fact that you've got a right hand, what else can you pretend to ignore? Can you have a negative heart? A hollow soul?
Chapter 14. How much for one roll? Phase one of the operation goes smoothly. I find the second door on the right in the corridor without being tempted to open the seven other doors. My bladder is that small. And complete phase two with a relief untarnished by embarrassment. It would have been cavalier to question Monsieur Ouzou about his bathroom. No mere bathroom could be white as snow, from the walls to the toilet bowl, by way of an immaculate toilet seat on which one hardly dares be seated for fear of sullying it. All this whiteness, however, is tempered, so that the whole business does not seem too clinical, by a sunbright, yellow carpet that is thick, deep, silky, satiny, and caressing, and that rescues the place from any operating room atmosphere. From these observations, I conceive a great deal of respect for Monsieur Ouzou. The clean simplicity of white, with no marble or embellishments, a common weakness among the privileged classes, who seek to make anything trivial seem luxurious. And the gentle softness of a sun-bright carpet are, as far as toilet fixtures go, the very prerequisites of consonance. What are we looking for when we go there? A bit of light, to keep us from thinking of all those dark depths swirling together below us, and something soft on the floor, so that we can get our task accomplished without doing penance by freezing our feet, particularly when we go there at night. The toilet paper, too, is a candidate for sainthood. I find this sign of wealth far more convincing than any Maserati or Jaguar. What toilet paper does for people's derrières contributes considerably more to the abyss between the classes than a good many external signs. The paper at Monsieur Ouzou's abode, thick, soft, gentle, and delicately perfumed, is there to lavish respect upon a part of the body that, more than any other, is partial to such respect. How much for one roll, I wonder, as I press the middle flush button, which is crossed with two lotus flowers. My tiny bladder, despite its lack of autonomy, can hold a fair amount. One lotus flower seems a bit skimpy. Three would be narcissistic. And then something dreadful happens. A monstrous racket assails my ears, practically striking me down on the spot. What is terrifying is that I cannot tell where it is coming from. It is not the flush. I cannot even hear the flush. It is coming from above me and right down upon me. My heart is pounding wildly. You know what the three alternatives are. In the face of danger, fight, flee, or freeze. I freeze. I would gladly flee, but suddenly I'm no longer capable of unlocking the door. A number of hypotheses spring to mind, but offer no explanation. Did I press the wrong button? Misjudging the amount produced? Such presumptuousness, such pride, Renee! 2 lotus flowers for such a ridiculous contribution. And consequently, I'm being punished by the ear-splitting thunder of divine justice? Am I guilty of overindulging? Of luxuriating in the voluptuousness of the act in a place that inspires voluptuousness when we should actually think of it as impure? Did I succumb to envy in coveting this princely asswipe and have therefore been roundly reminded of my deadly sin? Have my lumpen manual laborer's fingers, succumbing to the effect of some unconscious wrath, abused the subtle mechanism of the lotus button, thereby unleashing a cataclysm in the plumbing that threatens the entire fourth floor with seismic collapse? I am still trying with all my strength to flee, but my hands are incapable of obeying orders. I fiddle with the copper latch, which, if correctly operated, ought to set me free, but nothing of the sort occurs. At that very moment, I am convinced I have gone mad, or have arrived in heaven, because the unholy racket, indistinguishable thus far, now becomes clearer, and unthinkably sounds not unlike Mozart. Sounds, in fact, like the Confutatis in Mozart's Requiem. Confutatis maledictis, flammis acribus addictis. I am hearing beautiful lyrical voices. I have gone mad. Madame Michel, is everything all right? Asks a voice from behind the door. It is Monsieur Ozu's voice, or more likely that of St. Peter at the gates of Purgatory. I can't open the door. I have been doing everything in my power to convince Monsieur Ozu of my mental deficiency. And I have succeeded. Perhaps you are turning the knob in the wrong direction, suggests the voice of St. Peter, respectfully. I ponder this information for a moment, while it makes its tortuous way to the circuits that will process it. I turn the knob in the other direction. The door unlocks. The Confutatis comes to an abrupt end. A delicious wave of silence washes over my grateful body. I say to Monsieur Ozu, for there is no one else here. Well, you know the Requiem? I should have named my cat. Bad syntax. Oh, I imagine you were frightened, he says. I should have warned you. This is a Japanese thing. My daughter's idea to import it. When you flush, it sets off the music. It's more pleasant, you see? What I see, above all, is that we are standing in the hallway, outside the toilet, in a situation that is blasting to smithereens all world records for ridiculousness. Oh, I say. I was surprised. And I make no mention of all my deadly sins exposed in broad daylight. You are not the first, says Monsieur Ozu kindly, and, if I am not mistaken, with a trace of amusement on his upper lip. Mozart's Requiem, in the bathroom. It's rather surprising, I answer, in order to regain my composure. Then I am immediately horrified by the turn I have given the conversation, and in the meanwhile we are still standing in the hallway, facing each other, arms dangling, uncertain what to do next. Monsieur Ozu looks at me. I look at him. Something snaps in my chest, with a decisive little click, like a valve opening and shutting again. Then I notice, helplessly, that my body is trembling slightly, and it never rains but it pours. The same incipient trembling has gained the shoulders of the man standing opposite me. We look at each other, hesitating. Then a sort of faint, gentle ooh-ooh-ooh escapes from Monsieur Ozu's lips. I realize that the same muffled but irrepressible ooh is rising in my own throat. Both of us are going ooh very quietly, looking at each other incredulously. Then Monsieur Ozu's ooh grows more intense. My own ooh begins to resemble an alarm signal. We are still looking at each other, exhaling ever more restrained oohs from our lungs. Every time they begin to subside, we look at each other and are off on the next round. My guts are paralyzed, and tears are streaming down Monsieur Ozu's cheeks. How long do we stand there, laughing convulsively by the door to the bathroom? I have no idea, but it is long enough to deplete us of all our energy. We exhale a few more exhausted oohs, and then, more fatigued than satiated, put on a straight face. Let's go back to the living room, says Monsieur Ozu, quicker than me, to regain the use of his respiratory faculties. Chapter 15. A very civilized, noble savage. It's certainly not boring with you around, is the first thing Monsieur Ozu says to me once we are back in the kitchen and I am comfortably perched on my stool, sipping lukewarm sake, which I find fairly bland. You are no ordinary person, he adds, pushing in my direction a small bowl filled with little raviolis, which look neither fried nor steamed, but somewhere in between. Next to them, he places a bowl of soy sauce. Gyozas, he explains. On the contrary, I reply, I think I'm a very ordinary person. I'm a concierge. My life is a model of banality. A concierge who reads Tolstoy and listens to Mozart. I did not know this was one of the skills required for your profession. And he winks at me. Without further ado, he sits down beside me and applies his chopsticks to his own serving of gyozas. Never in my life have I felt so at ease. How can I explain? For the first time, I feel utterly trusting, even though I am not alone. Even with Manuela, to whom I would gladly entrust my life, I do not have this feeling of absolute security that comes when one is sure that understanding is mutual. Entrusting one's life is not the same as opening up one's soul. And although I love Manuela like a sister, I cannot share with her the things that constitute the tiny portion of meaning and emotion that my incongruous existence has stolen from the universe. With my chopsticks, I savor the gyozas stuffed with coriander and delicately spiced meat. Aware of a staggering sense of well-being, I chat with Monsieur Ozu as if we have known each other forever. One must have some entertainment after all, I say. I go to the local library and borrow everything I can. Do you like Dutch painting? He asks. And without waiting for my reply, if you were given the choice between Dutch painting and Italian painting, which would you rescue? We argue back and forth. A mock heated exchange where I take a passionate defense of Vermeer, but very quickly it becomes apparent that whatever we might say, we still agree with each other. You think it's a sacrilege? I ask. Not at all, chère madame, he replies, jauntily waving an unfortunate ravioli from left to right above his bowl. Not at all. Do you think I would have copied Michelangelo to have it hanging in my hallway? You dip the noodles in this sauce, he adds, placing before me a wicker basket filled with noodles and a sumptuous blue-green bowl that is giving off an aroma of peanuts. This is a zalu ramen, a dish of cold noodles with a slightly sweet sauce. Tell me if you like it. And he hands me a heavy linen napkin. There might be some collateral damage. Mind your dress. Thank you. Goodness knows why, I add. It isn't mine. I take a deep breath and say, you know, I've been living alone for so long, and I never go out. I'm afraid I might be something of a noble savage. A very civilized noble savage, in that case, he says, smiling. The taste of noodles dipped in peanut sauce is heavenly. I cannot, however, swear to the purity of Maria's dress. It is not very easy to plunge a yard's length of noodle into a semi-liquid sauce and then swallow it without making a bit of a mess. but as Monsieur Ozu is able to manage his own noodles quite adroitly, making a considerable amount of noise all the while, this removes any complex I might have. I proceed merrily to slurp up my long ribbons of noodle. "Seriously," says Monsieur Ozu, "do you not find it amazing? Your cat is called Leo. Mine are Kitty and Levin. We both love Tolstoy and Dutch painting, and we live in the same place. What are the odds of such a thing happening?" "You shouldn't have given me that beautiful book," I say. "It wasn't necessary." "Chère madame," replies Monsieur Ozu, "did it make you happy?" "Well, of course it made me very happy, but also rather nervous. You know, I would like to remain discreet. I don't want the people here imagining who you are."
"Why?"
"I don't want any fuss. No one wants a concierge who gives herself airs."
"Airs? But you don't give yourself airs. You have taste and qualities. You are enlightened."
"But I'm the concierge. And anyway, I have no education. I'm not part of that world."
"A fine affair," says Monsieur Ozu,
"in exactly the same way, would you believe, as Manuela, and this makes me laugh." He raises an eyebrow, questioning. "That's my best friend's favorite expression," I say, by way of an explanation.
"And what does she say, your best friend, about your discretion?"
"To be honest, I haven't a clue." "You know her," I say. "It's Manuela."
"Ah, Madame Lopez. She's your friend?"
"She's my only friend."
"She is a great woman, an aristocrat. You see, you are not the only one who goes against the social norm. What's the harm in that? This is the 21st century, for goodness sake."
"What did your parents do?" I ask,
somewhat ruffled by his lack of discernment. No doubt Monsieur Ozu thinks that privilege disappeared with Zola. "My father was a diplomat. I did not know my mother. She died shortly after I was born."
"I'm sorry." He makes a gesture with his hand, as if to say it was long ago.
I forge ahead with my idea.
"You are the son of a diplomat. I am the daughter of impoverished peasants. It is inconceivable for me even to be having dinner here this evening."
"And yet, you are having dinner here this evening."
And he adds with a very sweet smile,
"And I am very honored."
The conversation continues in this vein, good-natured and natural. We talk about, in order, Yasujiro Ozu, a distant relation, Tolstoy, and Levin mowing the field with his peasants, exile and the irreducibility of culture, and many other subjects which we debate in succession with the enthusiasm of discovering our shared interest, while enjoying the last of the mountain of noodles, and, above all, the disconcerting similarity in the working of our minds. At one point, Monsieur Ozu turns to me and says,
"I would like for you to call me Kakuro. It would be so much less awkward. Do you mind if I call you Rene?"
"Not at all," I reply. "And I really do not mind." Where have I suddenly found this ability to feel such ease in close company? No answer is required for the time being, for the sake has muddled my brain in a quite delightful way.
"Do you know what Azuki beans are?" asks Kakuro.
"The mountains of Kyoto," I say, smiling at my memory of infinity.
"What?"
"The mountains of Kyoto are the color of Azuki bean paste," I say, trying hard nevertheless to articulate.
"That's from a film, isn't it?"
"Yes, in The Sisters Munikata at the very end."
"Oh, I saw that film a long time ago, but I don't remember it very well."
"Don't you remember the camellia on the moss of the temple?"
"No, not at all. But you make me want to see it again. Would you like to watch it together someday soon?"
"I have the cassette. I haven't taken it back to the library yet."
"This weekend, perhaps?"
Do you have a VCR?
Yes, he says, smiling.
That's settled then. But let me make the following suggestion. Let's watch the film at tea time on Sunday, and I'll bring the pastries.
Agreed, says Kakuro.
The evening unfolds while we go on talking with little regard for coherence or the passage of time, endlessly sipping herbal tea with a strange seaweedy taste. Not surprisingly, I must renew my acquaintance with the snow-colored toilet bowl and the sun-bright carpet. I select the one lotus flower button this time. Message received. And weather the assault of the confutatis with all the serenity of a long-time regular. What is both disconcerting and marvelous about Kakuro Ozu is that he combines a sort of childish enthusiasm and candor with the attentiveness and kindliness of an old sage. I am not accustomed to such a relationship with the world. It seems to me that he views it with indulgence and curiosity, whereas the other human beings I know display either wariness and kindness, Manuela, ingenuity and kindness, Olamp, or arrogance and cruelty, everyone else. Such a combination of eagerness, lucidity, and magnanimity is delightfully unusual. And then I look down at my watch. It is 3 o'clock. I jump to my feet. Good Lord, have you seen the time? He consults his own watch, then looks up with an anxious gaze.
I had forgotten that you are working early tomorrow. I'm retired. I don't pay any attention to that anymore. Will you be all right?
Yes, of course, but I have to get some sleep all the same.
I did not mention the fact that in spite of my advanced age, although everyone knows old people do not sleep a lot, in my case I must sleep like a log for at least 8 hours in order to have the slightest discernment in my dealings with the world.
See you Sunday, says Kakuro at his front door.
Thank you so much. I've had a lovely evening. I'm very grateful to you.
It is I who am grateful to you. I haven't laughed like that in a very long time, nor have I had such a pleasant conversation. Would you like me to walk you to your door?
No, thank you. There's no need.
There is always a potential paliere lurking in the stairways.
Well then, I'll see you on Sunday, I say,
unless we run into each other before then.
Thank you, René, he says again, with a broad, childlike grin.
I close my own door behind me and lean against it.
There is Leo snoring away like a trumpet in the TV armchair.
And I realize something unthinkable. For the first time in my life, I have made myself a friend.
Chapter 16. And then.
And then, a summer rain.
Chapter 17. A new heart. I remember that summer rain. Day after day, we pace up and down our life the way we pace up and down a passageway.
Don't forget the lung for the cat. Have you seen my scooter? This is the third time it's gotten stolen.
It's raining so hard you'd think it was night.
We'll just make it. The next show is at 1.
Do you want to take off your raincoat?
Cup of bitter tea. Silence of the afternoon.
Perhaps we are sick from too much.
All these bonces to water.
Those giddy young things who run wild.
Look, it's snowing.
Those flowers, what are they called?
Poor sweetie, she was peeing all over the place.
An autumn sky. How sad.
It gets dark so early now.
Why does the garbage smell all the way out into the courtyard?
You know, everything comes at its appointed time.
No, I didn't know them especially well.
They were a family like all the others here.
It is the color of azuki bean paste. My son says the Chinese are very hard to deal with. What are his cats called?
Would you be so good as, comma, to sign for the packages from the dry cleaners?
All the Christmases, these carols, the shoppings are tiring.
When you eat a walnut, you must use a tablecloth.
His nose is running, what do you know? It's already hot, it's not even 10 yet. I slice some mushrooms real thin, and we have our bouillon with those mushrooms in it. She leaves her filthy underpants under the bed.
We should redo the wallpaper. And then, summer rain.
Do you know what a summer rain is? To start with, pure beauty striking the summer sky. Awe-filled respect, absconding with your heart. A feeling of insignificance at the very heart of the sublime, so fragile and swollen with the majesty of things, trapped, ravished, amazed by the bounty of the world. And then you pace up and down a corridor, and suddenly you enter a room full of light, another dimension, a certainty just given birth. The body is no longer a prison. Your spirit roams the clouds. You possess the power of water. Happy days are in store in this new birth. Just as teardrops, when they are large and round and compassionate, can leave a long strand washed clean of discord, the summer rain, as it washes away the motionless dust, can bring to a person's soul something like endless breathing. That is the way a summer rain can take hold in you, like a new heart beating in time with another's. Chapter 18. Gentle Insomnia. After 2 hours of gentle insomnia, I fall peacefully asleep.
Profound thought number 13. Who presumes to make honey without sharing the bee's fate? Every day I tell myself that my sister cannot possibly sink any further into the slough of disgrace. And every day, I am amazed to see that she does. This afternoon, after school, there was no one at home. I took some hazelnut chocolate from the kitchen and went to eat it in the living room. I was comfortably settled on the sofa, nibbling on my chocolate and ruminating on my next profound thought. I was thinking that it would be a profound thought about chocolate, or the way you nibble it in particular, with a central question: what is it that is so good about chocolate? The substance itself, or the technique of chewing it? But however interesting I may have found my subject, I had not factored in the presence of my sister, who had come home earlier than expected and who immediately began to poison my existence by talking to me about Italy. Ever since she went to Venice with Tiber and his parents, staying at the Danieli, that's all she talks about. To make things even worse, on Saturday they went to have dinner at some friends of the Glen Parle, who have a huge estate in Tuscany. Colombe now gets ecstatic just saying, "Tuscany," and Maman chimes in. In case you didn't know, Tuscany is not an ancient land. It exists solely to give people like Colombe, Maman, or the Glen Parle a frisson of possession. Tuscany belongs to them, just as culture and art do, or anything else you can write with a capital letter. Speaking of Tuscany, then, I've already been treated to the donkeys, the olive oil, the light at sunset, the dolce vita, or whatever other cliches they could come up with. But because each time I'd managed to slip away quietly, Colombe had not yet been able to try out her favorite story on me. So she made up for it when she saw me on the sofa, and she spoiled my tasting session and my nascent profound thought. On Tibale's parents' friend's estate, there are beehives, enough of them to produce 100 kilos of honey a year. Even though the Tuscans hired a beekeeper who does all the work, they market their honey as Flibaggi Estate. Obviously, they don't do it for the money. But Fleabody Estate Honey is considered to be one of the best in the world, and it adds to the owner's prestige. They live off their private income. Because it's used in all the best restaurants by the most illustrious chefs, who make a great fuss about it. Colombe, Thibert, and Thibert's parents were treated to a tasting session as if it were wine. And Colombe could go on forever about the difference between thyme honey and rosemary honey. That will really come in handy someday. Up to this point in her story, I was listening distractedly while thinking of my crunching into the chocolate, and I figured if her story were to stop at this point, I would be getting off lightly. But you can't ever hope for such a thing from Colombe. Suddenly, she put on her superior air and started telling me about the behavior of bees. Apparently, they were given an in-depth account, and Colombe's nasty little mind was particularly taken with the passage on the nuptial rites of queens and drones. The incredible organization of the hive, on the other hand, did not seem to make that much of an impression on her, although I think it's fascinating, especially the fact that these insects have a coded language. All the claims that verbal intelligence is specifically human begin to seem rather relative. But that's not the sort of thing that would ever interest Colombe. She's not working toward a vocational training certificate to become a plumber, after all. She's after a master's in philosophy. Nevertheless, she is absolutely titillated by the sexual lives of tiny creatures. To sum up, the queen bee, when she is ready, takes off on her nuptial flight, pursued by a cloud of drones. The first drone to reach her copulates with her, then dies, because after the act, his genital organ remains stuck inside. So he is amputated, and this kills him. The second drone to reach the queen in order to copulate with her has to remove the genital organ of the previous drone with his feelers, and, of course, the same thing will happen to him, and so on and so forth, until you end up with 10 or 15 drones who have filled up the queen's sperm pouch and will enable her, in the course of 4 or 5 years, to produce 200,000 eggs a year. This is what Colombe is telling me, looking at me with her spiteful air, embellishing her story with saucy comments like, "She only gets one shot at it, huh? So she uses up 15 drones. If I were Thibert, I wouldn't appreciate my girlfriend going around telling everyone this story. Because, well, you can't help but do a little bit of dime store psychology. When a randy girl goes around saying that it takes 15 males to satisfy one female, and that to thank them she castrates them and kills them, well, you can't help but wonder. Colombe is convinced this makes her look like the liberated, not-at-all-uptight girl who talks about sex perfectly naturally. And Colombe is forgetting that she's only telling me this story in order to shock me, and that in addition, the content of the story is not at all innocent. In the first place, for someone like me who thinks that people are animals, sexuality is not a salacious subject. It's a scientific matter. It's fascinating. And in the second place, I'd like to remind everyone that Colombe washes her hands 3 times a day and screams the moment she gets the slightest suspicion that there might be an invisible hair in the shower. Visible hairs are more improbable. I don't know why, but I think that all this goes very well with the sexuality of queens. But above all, it is crazy how people think that though they understand nature, they can live without it. If Colombe is telling this particular story in this particular way, it's because she thinks it has nothing to do with her. If she's poking fun at the drone's pathetic lovemaking, it's because she is convinced she will never be subjected to anything remotely similar. But I don't see anything shocking or saucy about the nuptial flight of the queens or the fate of the drones, because I feel profoundly similar to all those creatures, even if our behavior differs. Living, eating, reproducing, fulfilling the task for which we were born, and dying. It has no meaning, true, but that's the way things are. People are so arrogant, thinking they can coerce nature, escape their destiny of little biological things, and yet they remain so blind to the cruelty or violence of their own way of living, loving, reproducing, and making war on their fellow human beings. Personally, I think there is only one thing to do. Find the task we have been placed on this earth to do, and accomplish it as best we can, with all our strength, without making things complicated, or thinking there's anything divine about our animal nature. This is the only way we will ever feel that we have been doing something constructive when death comes to get us. Freedom, choice, will, and so on. Chimeras. We think we can make honey without sharing in the fate of bees, but we are in truth nothing but poor bees, destined to accomplish our task and then die.
Paloma. Chapter 1. Terribly sharp. At 7 a.m. that morning, someone rings the bell at my loge. It takes me a few seconds to emerge from the void. 2 hours of sleep do not leave a person feeling terribly well-disposed toward mankind, and the ringing that persists as I hastily throw on my dress and slippers and run my hand through my curiously puffy hair does little to stimulate my altruism. I open the door and find myself face to face with Colombe Joss.
"Well," she says, "were you caught in a traffic jam?"
I cannot believe what I am hearing. "It is 7 in the morning, I say. She looks at me.
"Yes, I know,"
she says. "The loge opens at 8, I explain, making a great effort at self-control.
"What do you mean, at 8?
She asks, looking shocked.
"There are hours?"
"No, a concierge's loge is a protected sanctuary, oblivious of either social progress or labor laws."
"Yes,"
I say, incapable of another word.
"Oh,"
she replies, in a lazy voice.
"Well, since I'm already here,
you can stop by later." I slam the door in her face and make a beeline for the kettle. Through the windowpane, I hear her shout,
"Well, that takes the cake!"
Then turn furiously on her heels and press all her rage into the button to call the elevator. Colombe is the elder Joss' daughter. Colombe Joss is also a sort of tall blonde leek who dresses like a penniless bohemian. If there is one thing I despise, it is the perverse affectation of rich people who go around dressing as if they were poor, in secondhand clothes, ill-fitting gray wool bonnets, socks full of holes, and flowered shirts under threadbare sweaters. Not only is it ugly, it is also insulting. Nothing is more despicable than a rich man's scorn for a poor man's longing. Unfortunately, Colombe Joss also happens to be a brilliant student. This autumn, she enrolled in philosophy at the École Normale Supérieure. I make my tea with some cherry plum jam cookies, and try to master the trembling rage afflicting my hands, while an insidious headache worms its way into my brain. I take an exasperated shower, get dressed, bestow an absolutely abject meal upon Leo, head cheese and damp leftover cheese rind, go out into the courtyard, take out the garbage, remove Neptune from the garbage can room, and by 8 o'clock, weary of all this to and fro, I repair to my kitchen, not the least bit calmer for all that. The Joss family also have a younger daughter, Paloma, who is so discreet and diaphanous that I have the impression I never see her, although she does go out to school every day. But lo and behold, it is Paloma who, at 8 on the dot, shows up as Colombe's envoy. What a cowardly trick. The poor child, how old is she, 11, 12, is standing on my doormat, stiff as justice. I take a deep breath. I would not want to transfer the rage inspired by the evil onto the innocent, and try to smile as naturally as possible. "Good morning, Paloma." She fiddles hesitantly with the bottom of her pink vest.
"Good morning."
Her voice is reedy. I look at her carefully. How could I have missed this? Some children have the awkward talent of intimidating adults. Nothing in their behavior corresponds to the standards of their age group. They are too serious, too imperturbable, and at the same time, terribly sharp. Yes, sharp. If I observe Paloma carefully, I detect a trenchant acuity, a chilly, wise way about her, which I suppose I had always taken for reserve, simply because it was impossible for me to imagine that the flighty Colombe could have a judge of humanity for a sister.
My sister Colombe has sent me to alert you to the fact that she is expecting the delivery of a very important envelope, says Paloma.
Very well, I reply, mindful not to soften my own tone the way adults do when they speak to children, something which in the end is as much an indication of scorn as rich people wearing poor people's rags.
She asks if you can bring it up to the house, continues Paloma.
Yes. And she goes on standing there. This is all very interesting. She goes on standing there, staring at me calmly, without moving, her arms by her side, her lips slightly parted. She has skinny braids, glasses with pink frames, and very large light eyes.
Would you like a cup of hot chocolate? I ask, running out of ideas.
She nods, as imperturbable as ever. Come in. I was just having some tea.
And I leave the door to the loge open to avert any accusations of child abduction.
I prefer tea myself, if you don't mind, she says.
No, not at all, I reply, somewhat surprised, observing mentally that a certain amount of data is being stored. The judge of humanity, in a nice turn of phrase, prefers tea. She sits on a chair and swings her feet in the void, looking at me while I pour out her jasmine tea. I put the cup down before her and sit down with my own cup.
Every day I do something so that my sister will think I'm a retard, she declares, after taking a connoisseur's long swallow. My sister spends entire evenings with her friends drinking and smoking and talking as if she were an underprivileged kid from the projects because she thinks her intelligence is beyond question.
Which seems to fit very squarely with the girl's no-fixed-abode sense of style.
I am here as her envoy because she's a coward and a chicken, continues Paloma, still staring at me with her big, clear eyes.
Well, it's given us the opportunity to get acquainted, I say politely.
May I come back?
She asks, and there is something of an entreaty in her voice.
Of course, I say. You're more than welcome. But I'm afraid you'll find it boring here. There's not much to do. I just want a place where I can have some peace, she responds.
Can't you have some peace in your own room?
No, there's no peace if everyone knows where I am. Before I used to hide, but now they've found out all my hiding places.
You know, people are constantly disturbing me, too. I don't know how much peace and quiet you'll find here.
I could stay there.
She points to the armchair by the television, which is on with the sound turned off.
People come to see you. They won't bother me.
It's fine with me, but first you will have to ask your mother if she agrees. Manuela, who starts her service at 8:30, pops her head in at the open door. She is about to say something when she sees Paloma with her steaming cup of tea. Come in, I say. We were just having some tea and a little chat. Manuela raises an eyebrow, which means, in Portuguese at least, what is she doing here? I give a faint shrug. She purses her lips, puzzled.
Well, she asks, all the same, incapable of waiting. Will you stop by later?
I ask with a huge smile.
Ah, she says, seeing my smile. Very good, very good. Yes, I'll come back the usual time.
Then, looking at Paloma,
fine, I'll come back later.
And politely,
goodbye, mademoiselle.
Goodbye, says Paloma, with her first faint smile, a poor little out-of-practice smile that breaks my heart.
You must go on home now, I say.
Your family will be getting worried. She stands up and heads for the door, dragging her feet.
It is patently clear, she says, that you are very intelligent.
And since I am too taken aback to say anything else, you have found a good hiding place. Chapter 2. For All Its Invisibility. The envelope that the courier drops off at my loge for Her Majesty Colombe de la Riffraff is open.
wide open, without ever having been sealed closed. The adhesive flap still has its white protective strip, and the envelope is gaping open like an old shoe, revealing a pile of sheets bound together with a spiral. Why did no one take the trouble to close it, I wonder? Eliminating the hypothesis of trust in the integrity of couriers and concierges, and assuming, rather, a belief that the contents of the envelope could hardly be of interest to them. I swear on all the saints that this is the first time, and I can only pray that the facts, little sleep, summer rain, Paloma, and so on, will be taken into consideration. Very gently, I remove the pile from its envelope.
Colomjas, the argument of Potentia Dei Absoluta, master's thesis, under the direction of Professor Marianne, University of Paris 1, Sorbonne.
There's a card clipped to the first page. Dear Colomjas, here are my notes.
Thank you for the courier. I will see you at the Solchoir tomorrow. Regards, J. Marianne.
In the introduction, I discover that the topic is medieval philosophy. It is, moreover, a thesis on William of Ockham, a Franciscan monk, philosopher, and logician of the 14th century. As for the Solchoir, it is a library of religious and philosophical sciences in the 13th arrondissement, run by Dominican monks. The library has a considerable collection of medieval literature, including, I'll wager, the complete works of William of Ockham, in Latin, in 15 volumes. How do I know this? Well, I went there a few years ago. For what purpose? None in particular. I had found this library on a map of Paris, and it seemed to be open to the public, so I went there as a collector. I wandered up and down between the stacks, which were set far apart, and peopled exclusively by very learned old gentlemen or students with pretentious airs about them. I have always been fascinated by the abnegation with which we human beings are capable of devoting a great deal of energy to the quest for nothing and to the rehashing of useless and absurd ideas. I spoke with a young doctoral candidate in Greek patristics and wondered how so much youth could be squandered in the service of nothingness. When you consider that a primate's major preoccupations are sex, territory, and hierarchy, spending one's time reflecting on the meaning of prayer for Augustine of Hippo seems a relatively futile exercise. To be sure, there are those who will argue that mankind aspires to meaning beyond mere impulses. But I would counter that while this is certainly true, otherwise what am I doing with literature, it is also utterly false. Meaning is merely another impulse. An impulse carried to the highest degree of achievement in that it uses the most effective means, understanding, to attain its goals. For the quest for meaning and beauty is hardly a sign that man has an elevated nature, that by leaving behind his animal impulses, he will go on to find the justification of his existence in the enlightenment of the spirit. No, it is a primed weapon in the service of a trivial and material goal. And when the weapon becomes its own subject, this is the simple consequence of the specific neuronal wiring that distinguishes us from other animals. By allowing us to survive, the efficiency of intelligence also offers us the possibility of complexity without foundation, thought without usefulness, and beauty without purpose. It's like a computer bug, a consequence without consequence of the subtlety of our cortex, a superfluous perversion making an utterly wasteful use of the means at its disposal. But even when the quest does not wander off in this way, it remains a necessity that does not depart from animality. Literature, for example, serves a pragmatic purpose. Like any form of art, literature's mission is to make the fulfillment of our essential duties more bearable. For a creature like man, who must forge his destiny by means of thought and reflexivity, the knowledge gained from this will perforce be unbearably lucid. We know that we are beasts who have this weapon for survival, and that we are not gods creating a world with our own thoughts, and something has to make our own wisdom bearable. Something has to save us from the woeful, eternal fever of biological destiny. Therefore, we have invented
art. Our animal selves have devised another way to ensure the survival of our species. Truth loves nothing better than simplicity of truth. That is the lesson Colombe Josse ought to have learned from her medieval readings. But all she seems to have gleaned from her studies is how to make a conceptual fuss in the service of nothing. It is a sort of endless loop, and also a shameless waste of resources, including the courier and my own self. I leaf through pages that contain scarcely any comments, although this must be a final version, and am filled with dismay. Granted, the young woman has a fairly efficient way with words, despite her youth, but the fact that the middle classes are working themselves to the bone, using their sweat and taxes to finance such pointless and pretentious research, leaves me speechless. Every gray morning, day after gloomy day, secretaries, craftsmen, employees, petty civil servants, taxi drivers, and concierge shoulder their burden so that the flower of French youth, duly housed and subsidized, can squander the fruit of all that dreariness upon the altar of ridiculous endeavors. And yet, at the outset, Colombe's thesis has every reason to be enthralling. Do universals exist or only singular things, is the question to which, I gather, William of Ockham devoted most of his life. I am fascinated by his query. Is each thing an individual entity? If so, whatever is identical from one thing to another is merely an illusion or an effect of language proceeding through words and concepts, through generalities, designating and embracing several particular things? Or do general forms truly exist, of which singular things are but a part and not the mere result of language? When we say a table, when we utter the word table, when we make the concept of the table, are we still designating only this table? Or are we truly referring to a universal table entity that establishes the reality of all the particular tables that exist? Is the idea of the table real, or does it merely belong to the mind? If that is so, then why are certain objects identical? Is it language that is grouping them together artificially into general categories for the convenience of human understanding? Or does a universal form exist to which every specific form belongs? As far as Will of Ockham is concerned, things are singular, and the realism of universals is erroneous. There are only particular realities. Generality is merely in the mind. And to presume that generic realities exist is merely to make what is simple complicated. But can we be so sure? Was I not seeking congruence between Raphael and Vermeer only yesterday? The eye recognizes a shared form to which both belong, and that is beauty. And I dare say there must be reality in that form. It cannot be a simple expedient of the human mind, classifying in order to understand, and discerning in order to apprehend. For you cannot classify something that is not classifiable. You cannot put things together that cannot be together in a group, or gather those that cannot be gathered. A table can never be a view of Delft. The human mind cannot create this dissimilarity, any more than it can invent the deep solidarity connecting a Dutch still life to an Italian virgin and child. In every table, there is an essence that gives it its form. And similarly, every work of art belongs to a universal form that alone confers its seal upon the work. To be sure, we cannot perceive this universality directly. That is one of the reasons why so many philosophers have balked at considering essences to be real. For I will only ever see the table that is before me, and not the universal table form, only the painting, and not the very essence of beauty. And yet it is there, before our eyes. Every painting by a Dutch master is an incarnation
of beauty. A dazzling apparition that we can only contemplate through the singular, but that opens a tiny window onto eternity and the timelessness of a sublime form. Eternity, for all its invisibility, we gaze at it. Chapter 3. The Just Crusade.
So, do you think all of this is of any interest to our aspiring candidate for intellectual glory?
'Tis most unlikely. Colomjas, who has no ongoing preoccupation with beauty or the destiny of tables, is relentless in her exploration of Occam's philosophical thought. But she ventures only where her utterly uninteresting semantic simpering cares to take her. The most remarkable thing is the intention that presides over her undertaking, and that is to make Occam's philosophical theses into the consequence of his conception of God's action, by reducing his years of philosophical labor to the rank of a secondary excrescence of his theological thought. It is sidereal, as inebriating as bad wine, and above all, a perfect illustration of the way the university works. If you want to make a career, take a marginal exotic text, William Occam's Sum of Logic, that is relatively unexplored, abuse its literal meaning by ascribing to it an intention that the author himself had not been aware of, because as we all know, the unknown in conceptual matters is far more powerful than any conscious design. Distort that meaning to the point where it resembles an original thesis. It is the concept of the absolute power of God that is the basis of a logical analysis, the philosophical implications of which are ignored. Burn all your icons while you're at it. Atheism, faith in reason, as opposed to the reason of faith, love of wisdom and other bagatelles dear to the hearts of socialists. Devote a year of your life to this unworthy little game at the expense of a collectivity whom you drag from their beds at 7 in the morning and send a courier to your research director. What is the purpose of intelligence if it is not to serve others? And I'm not referring to the false servitude that high-ranking state-employed flunkies exhibit so proudly. As if it were a badge of virtue, the facade of humility they wear is nothing more than vanity and disdain. Cloaked every morning in the ostentatious modesty of the high-ranking civil servant, Étienne de Broglie convinced me long ago of the pride of his caste. Inversely, privilege brings with it true obligations. If you belong to the closed inner sanctum of the elite, you must serve in equal proportion to the glory and ease of material existence you derive from belonging to that inner sanctum. What would I do if I were Colomjas, a young student at the École Normale, with all my future before me? I would dedicate myself to the progress of humanity, with resolving issues that are crucial for the survival, well-being, and elevation of mankind, with the fate of beauty in the world, or with the just crusade for philosophical authenticity. It's not a calling. There are choices. The field is wide. You do not take up philosophy the way you enter the seminary, with a credo as your sword and a single path as your destiny. Should you study Plato, Epicurus, Descartes, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, or even Husserl?